I'll just remind the parties, counsel for the appellant cross-respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument. And then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So, whenever you're ready, counsel for the appellant, if you can just approach the microphone, adjust the podium and the microphone to your level, and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am David Crosby. With me is Casey Phillips. We're from Stinson. We represent the appellant and cross-respondent, Rory Andrews. On the issue of undue influence, the trial court made a determination that there was no undue influence in 2016 as to Marietta Andrews' estate planning. Deference, however, to a trial court's findings is not absolute. As I noted in my brief, we understand it's rare for a court of appeals to be looking at a trial court's findings.
Well, I'm sure Chief Judge Cleary made that clear to Ms. Phillips when she was here.
Yes, okay, yes. Yes, absolutely. And so we talked about a lot, but we also looked, okay, what do those documents show? And when the documents are objective evidence.
Doesn't the district court have the right to look at the documents, hear the live testimony, and make credibility determinations that, well, you know, yeah, that seems a little odd, but I do believe Erickson's explanation. And what are we to do about that?
Right. Of course the district court has the right to do that. You, perhaps better than anyone as a former district court judge, know that. But if the witness's story is so implausible or contradicts the written evidence on their face, as we cited in the Anderson and the U.S. Gypsum case, the Court of Appeals may still find clear error. And I think we've thrown a lot of documents at you. We've thrown a lot of facts. Obviously, you weren't there at trial. That's very difficult, which is, again, why the Court of Appeals typically doesn't get into this. But I'm going to focus today on two exhibits. And I think this encapsulates the whole case.
Mr. Crosby, before you do that, isn't the additional hurdle of our typical disdain for credibility determinations is the burden of proof in this matter that clear and convincing evidence of undue influence? So that would suggest, even if you got the 50-50 kind of credibility determinations, it's not the clear and convincing. It might be, you know, be more likely than not, but that still doesn't get you there. And so would you agree that at least that's an additional hurdle as we review the district court's findings?
I'll agree. Yeah, I mean, that's obviously the standard, clear and convincing evidence. But there are, for example, the Olson case talks about clear error in a probate finding. And so this is a court of equity. Again, I think if we look at two exhibits here, Exhibit 17 and Exhibit 16, and how the district court treated those exhibits, or more fairly to say, ignored those exhibits and what's in them, that's where we get to, is it so internally inconsistent or implausible on its face, the court's finding, that clear error exists. So let's look at Exhibit 17. These are 12 pages of Attorney Erickson's notes the day Marietta signs her Second Amendment, September 7th. Now, in respondent's reply brief, they try to marry this document with the notion that Marietta always wanted Rory to get nothing or next to nothing. Now, Mark quotes Erickson. Respondent quotes Erickson in his notes saying, if you want to change your plan, that is your choice. Rory will likely end up with less. And that's this exhibit 17 on page 8. This was number one of 5 numbered paragraphs on those pages of the exhibit. In the margins next to paragraph 1, however, in that same page, Erickson writes, you told me, and we planned, and you signed documents that create trust assets going to Sandy and up to $100,000 going to Rory. And then in the margin next to that, Erickson writes, MLA says, this is still what she wants. So this concept that she never wanted Rory to get anything, even on the day of September 7th, is contradicted by Erickson's testimony, Erickson's own notes, I should say. And the paragraph immediately after the paragraph cited by Mark, Erickson explains to Marietta that he will need to talk to Mark about going and getting the bank accounts changed because all these bank accounts now had Mark and his daughter as joint tenants. And in the margin next to those words, Erickson writes, Marietta says, okay. Erickson said, I can do it nice. There's not one other word in these 12 pages of notes the day that she signs the September 7th amendment suggesting that Marietta was unhappy with the plan she had been working on for the past several months with Erickson. Now, one other thing I want to point out is Erickson knew. Page 5 of these notes. Bringing Mark in to, quote, talk about it is what we have tried to stay away from. If you, triple underline, you want to do what you planned, see the letter, see the documents you just signed, then you would tell, underline, Mark, what you want done with those accounts, and we would not, quote, talk about it. I can explain to Mark for you as your lawyer if you want me to. I am concerned that if it is left between you and Mark, that it will not get done. Erickson does not let Marietta sign the will unless she is satisfied, also in those notes. Not satisfied, I guess, but satisfied. He doesn't go forward with it. But then Erickson testifies later in deposition in a trial, well, she told me that very same day, I want Rory to get nothing. And that was her clear instruction, and I started working on him getting nothing. Well, does that square up with Exhibit 16, the one other document I want to talk to you about today? This is Mark's call to Erickson's office the next day, the notes of that call. Reading from it, it says, Mark said he talked with Marietta about the will and trust, and she agrees. Not she's decided, but she agrees. Well, agrees with who? Had to have been Mark or Sandy. Changes should be made, and Mark would like to speak with you on what it is that Marietta didn't understand and what changes should be made.
Now, Mr. Crosby, this is the phone message that the paralegal took for what Mark allegedly said to her, or, you know, to relay to Erickson. Would that be a fair statement? You know, not to be blunt, but how do we know she didn't get it wrong? I mean, she didn't testify. God knows no one ever who worked for me ever took a bad phone message. But, I mean, you're right. That's what it says, but so what?
So what is, first of all, this was stipulated that it could come into evidence. Second, there was no dispute from either Erickson or Mark, who did testify at trial, that a communication such as this happened. There's nobody saying, I never called. What are you talking about? So
just that I'm clear, at trial, Mark testified, I agree, that is the substance. What is in the phone message is the substance of what I told the paralegal. Is that a fair statement?
That's my recollection,
okay.
Yes.
Fair enough.
Yes. And then he couldn't remember what changes should be made other than he thought it had to do with the tree farm. Now, of course, the tree farm is something that Mark and his wife always coveted. Marietta had said, I don't care what happens to it. When I die, you can sell it off. That was in the first meeting with Erickson. And in the September 7th agreement, the tree farm's excluded. And she supposedly understood that, according to Erickson. It's going to go to Sandy no matter what. It's not clear that Sandy and Mark understood that because they looked at the document that day. It's clear that they saw it on September 7th. At least Mark did. Erickson writes, I will call him, this is on the notes. I don't know if you read it, but it's worth pointing out here. I will call him, meaning Mark, but I will tell him that his telling me is very dangerous. And I will also need to have instructions directly from Marietta, and I will need to advise her as to what is best for her. Now, who writes that? If his testimony was, I knew what she wanted on the 7th. She said she didn't want what she had just signed, and after I just confirmed that I need you to be satisfied, not satisfied, I guess. And then who prepares five drafts of additional trusts that include Rory if she said, I don't want him in this? After she just said on the 7th, Marietta says this is what she still wants, up to $100,000 to Rory. And go talk to Mark because I need to have these accounts changed. How does that fit with the six factors? It fits them perfectly. But first, before I point that out, and this is going to the original questions about, well, doesn't the judge get the credibility determination? Yes, he does. But does he have the ability? Well, he certainly can. Is it appropriate to completely ignore this 17? Is it completely ignore 16? There's not one word referencing either one of these documents in his opinion. He just says Erickson testified that she wasn't satisfied. It doesn't make any sense. It's implausible. Why would you say that? Because he got found out. There's no other reason. But the six factors, singularity of provisions, this now gets to Judge Sleater's question. Okay, well, can we still reach that level of clear and convincing? Well, what are the factors? Singularity of provisions. Everything goes to Mark, well, Mark's family. Confidential relationship. Mark's her trustee. Disinheritance of those decedent would have been expected to remember. On September 7th, she wanted to give him $100,000. Opportunity. Cognitive issues are here. Steph, we're not bringing a new cause of action saying she didn't have capacity. No, she clearly had capacity. Anybody who can type an email saying, hey, we got a lot done in Brainerd, I really appreciated his help. The day that she signed the Second Amendment, she's got capacity. But she still has a diminished capacity, which has been acknowledged by Sandy and others. Satisfied, not satisfied, I guess. The active participation, that's the next factor. What does Mark's message say? Marietta agrees changes should be made. Not Marietta decided, Marietta agrees. And then, of course, the exercise of influence and persuasion. And again, we refer to Exhibit 17, page 5, about, hey, we're trying to keep Marco out of this. So we, on the issue of undue influence, we respectfully request that this court, albeit an admitted big step, reverse the findings of no undue influence of the district court as to the 2016 October will and restatement. I know I have only a few minutes left. I did want to talk briefly about the question of attorney's fees, because if this court decides, well, we're not going to do that, respect the decision, we then look at the $30,000 gift. Rory doesn't find out about the $30,000 gift for months after Marietta dies, for months after he brings this lawsuit. He only finds out about it during discovery. Now, in a proceeding involving administration of a trust, this court or the district court can award attorney's fees to any party as justice and equity may require. Mark never took any steps to ensure that this gift happened, contrary to what he knew about Marietta's intent. And of course, there's findings of the district court on this point, so I'm not going to read those to you here. But for a power of attorney under Minnesota Statute 523.21, Mark had to have the interest of the principal utmost in mind. And he said, I knew this is what she wanted. And in fact, he said, I was going to do it no matter what, because I felt I had a duty to do it. Well, it's not for him to decide out of the goodness of my heart, I'm going to take $30,000 and give it to Rory, because that's not his decision. Once she died, it's either his daughter's money under the trust or not, but he can't just say, well, I'm going to move some things around and do this. So he had to have known there was a duty, and the court found he did know there was a duty. He willfully and knowingly breached that duty. But for the court to then not award for a winning party on this point fees, that is inequitable. It encourages, I'm sorry, go ahead. I've cited both of that and the power of attorney statute.
As to administration of the because we've determined he gets nothing under the trust.
Right.
So how does he...
We won, right.
Under a statute that governs trust proceedings and whether or not the beneficiary has prevailed, when he's not a beneficiary, he didn't prevail there.
That's true, but he did prevail on the breach of fiduciary duty claim. I guess that's the point I'm trying to make. Not necessarily... So you're saying if you uphold Mark's claim that court was in error, I don't think there is much of it. I mean, you don't breach your fiduciary duty, but I'm going to hold that just because you didn't tell him about it, there should be fees?
So your best That's a stretch. For fees is based on the breach of fiduciary duty?
Yes. That is right. Obviously, if you reverse on the undue influence, we think there should be fees there, too.
I'm just looking for legal grounds for an award of fees, and I do the same statute governing trust proceedings and the fact that he breached his fiduciary duty to Marietta.
Into Rory. 523.21 says, if an attorney, in fact, is personally liable to any person, including the principal, who is injured by action taken by the attorney, in fact... It does require a finding of bad faith. There is no finding of bad faith here. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Crosby. We'll now hear for counsel for respondent, please.
May it please the court, counsel. Oh, I'm sorry. Is the microphone on? Thank you. My name is Nicolay Lyon, and I represent respondent Mark Battistini. So the appellant wants this case to be about what is fair, and to some extent, so did the district court. However, the law in Minnesota does not require a testator to be fair. It permits a testator to dispose of their assets in the way they see fit, regardless of whether everyone else would agree with their decision. When we drill down to the correct statutes and apply them to the facts, it's clear that Marietta Andrews' wishes must be upheld. Mark, someone who exemplifies the meaning of Midwestern salt of the earth, did not unduly influence Marietta or breach a legal duty under any accurate characterization of the facts. The district court correctly held that there was no undue influence when Marietta Andrews made her estate plan, but when it came to the findings of breach, the district court failed to apply the correct law and analyze the facts under the laws for a breach of fiduciary duty by an attorney in fact towards a third party. Exactly what you brought forth, Judge. There is an issue of whether the duty existed, and there's also an issue of bad faith. Marietta never directed Mark to make a gift to Rory, and her true intent on this topic is ambiguous at best. Marietta had no legal duty to make the gift to Rory, and therefore neither did Mark Battistini as her power of attorney. It really is that simple. As Mark had no duty to set aside funds for Rory, the district court erred by finding that Mark's inaction resulted in a loss of funds, quote, for Rory. Rory never had the funds to lose, nor was he ever promised the funds.
Ms. Lyon, what are we to make, as Mr. Crosby points out? You know, everything seemed to be going along, and the decedent, you know, signs the new agreement on September 7th, and, you know, according to Erickson, you know, yes, satisfied, that's what I wanted. And then, you know, there seems to have been some dramatic turn of events between the 7th and the next day. I mean, it would be different if the next day Ms. Andrews had sent an email saying, wait a minute, I've changed my mind, or I've read this and not what I wanted. Now that didn't happen, or at least did that happen? I mean, did the decedent send an email saying, changed my mind, Rory gets nothing, or looked at the documents, don't really like this anymore, want to do something for Rory differently?
No, there is no email. What we have is the phone message, which you very correctly pointed out was written by someone who did not testify at trial.
And did Mark testify that he agreed that that was the substance of the message he left with the paralegal?
He agreed that he called and said Marietta had more questions and that he needed to make another appointment for her.
Okay.
I don't know.
There's a lot more in the phone.
Yeah.
There's a lot more in the phone message than that, I mean, in all candor.
I think it's important to note, though, that Erickson went on to have two other in-person meetings with Marietta and wrote two more fulsome letters about the estate planning process. This
and at
is
those
literally
meetings,
like midpoint.
At those meetings, like the other meetings, Mark was not in those
that
meetings.
That is correct.
Okay.
So even if we accept the argument that he, you know, had some kind of dust up with Marietta and convinced her somehow that this wasn't going to be right, she had months and many contacts with Erickson to say, no, I don't want to do this, or Mark is pushing me, or to consult somebody else in her family. She did none of those things. And Erickson himself testified that she mentioned frequently throughout their counseling process that she didn't want Rory to get much, if anything. And if you follow through the notes, which I'm sure that you have and the district court did as well, it's really almost Erickson pushing the whole time for a gift to Rory. It's like he can see this problem coming in the future and he wants to do something to avert disaster. And Marietta is very strong-willed and she was having none of it. So in the end, all we have as evidence of this gift is the 929 letter from Erickson to Marietta with her estate plan saying, if you want this gift to Rory, to $30,000 gift to Rory to go to him, you need to do something about it immediately. She got that letter. It was addressed to her, not to Mark. Later, he got a copy of it after everything was signed. But because he's her attorney in fact, doesn't mean that he's required to go out and make bank accounts in favor of somebody else. He tried to take her to the bank to do it. She didn't want to do it. She actually was at home with her own car. She was still driving around at that point. She could have gone to the bank and arranged for the gift, but she did not. So if Marietta doesn't have a duty to give that gift to Rory, and she doesn't, it's just if you want to make this gift, you need to set this up.
Ms. Lyon, can I ask you about, as Mr. Crosby pointed out in the record, and it's kind of the flip side of course, your argument on the undue influence is because we do make deference to the judge and the, the findings, that the record indicates that Mark knew she wanted to do that. Wouldn't that trigger in and of itself an obligation? Because that's, if he knows that's what she wants as the principal and he's the attorney in fact, he'd just do it.
I'm glad that you asked that because I think the point here is that the statute itself does not include an affirmative duty to act for an attorney in fact. There is no obligation on their part to do something unless asked.
But that's what I'm getting at. Isn't that a reasonable or fair and maybe the only reasonable inference of that statement? That's an acknowledgement. That's what she wants me to do. That's what she wants to do, so he should do it. Are you saying the only way you could ever find a breach is an explicit statement that I want you to do what I want to do?
But she should have given him instruction, yes. The unrefuted testimony is that she never told him to do it. She received this letter. He tried to...
I assume the flip side is she never told him not to do it either.
That is correct. What Mark testified is that... getting into the last factor that wasn't addressed, bad faith, Mark testified that he felt sad that Rory was excluded and that he intended to make the gift because he felt that that was only morally fair. That was in his judgment. And he saw it in the letter and he thought, yeah, I'm going to do that. Unfortunately for him, he had a misunderstanding of how the power of attorney instrument works and he found out, oh, I can't do that. It expired with Marietta's death. So at that point, then he's caught in a difficult situation because he has a legal obligation as trustee of the trust, which he wasn't until she died. That was, counsel mentioned that he was trustee. He was not trustee until Marietta actually died. He was successor trustee before that point. He has an obligation to the beneficiaries of the trust and also as personal representative to follow what is in the will. Both of, you know, it was a pour over will, everything goes into the trust and the trust excludes Rory. The only way he can get around that is to get, you know, some sort of agreement amongst the proper beneficiaries that they will give Rory $30,000. And Rory filed this action before the creditor period had even expired. So he doesn't even have all the bills yet. He doesn't have all the assets yet. Who would, you know, go to somebody like Rory and say, well, we might have a gift for you? That would be a very dangerous and silly thing to do and could cause hurt feelings as well as other problems when you don't know if you can actually make the gift or not. So there isn't any sinister reason why he didn't know about the gift. Of course it was revealed in discovery because that was part of the estate planning documents.
Would it, Ms. Lane, is it a fair statement that there's no evidence in the record from Mark at trial saying, you know, Marietta told me she doesn't even want to do the $30,000. I mean,
no, there is no testimony one way or the other. However, Mr. Erickson was asked, you know, at the end of the day, after all this stuff, and you wrote this advisory letter, did you think Marietta really intended to make a gift to Rory? And Erickson himself said, I don't know. I mean, they've been back and forth on this, clearly, for over the entire period of the 5 months. It's just very unclear that Marietta ever wanted the gift to actually happen. And she gave no instructions. Therefore, Mark didn't have a duty, and he certainly didn't act in bad faith. He was intending to make the gift anyway if it was within his power. I do want to comment for a moment on fees. I think I have a couple of minutes left. The court knows that in Minnesota, the rule is that each party pays their own fees unless there is a statute that fee shifts. And in this case, in will contests, it's only permitted in two scenarios. When an interested person successfully opposes a will, he hasn't done it here, and when an interested person's claim results in a benefit to the estate. It's really clear here that appellant neither successfully opposed a will nor benefited the estate in any way with his claim. In fact, his refusal to accept his grandmother's decision has resulted in expensive litigation costs to the estate and probably caused a family breach that may well be irreparable. Do you have any?
I have a question.
Yes.
Was there an attempt to work with the beneficiaries to see about some sort of settlement?
Of course, that is not a matter of record. There was a discussion within the family.
Why, Ms. Lyon, well, you know, a benefit to the estate. Is it not a benefit to the estate to see that people who the testator wants to get money get the money? I mean,
it would be if that were certain, but as we have discussed, it's far from clear that Marietta ever expected this gift to actually occur, or that even if he did set up the bank account, that the funds would not be used later. As Erickson advised her in his letter, she could use it first, last, or whatever. She had no obligation to save that money for Rory.
Wasn't she using funds to provide for her own care in later years?
That is correct. So she used her liquid assets, and then, as the testimony shows, Mark cashed various certificates of deposit when they came due. If she needed more money to pay for care, then he would cash it then, and otherwise he would reinvest it. So she did go through her liquid assets while she paid for care at Hartwood.
So just that we're clear, there's nothing in the record to indicate that on any of the bank accounts on which Mark or the other family members were made either power of attorney or, you know, joint accounts, there's no evidence in the record that any of those funds went to anything except, you know, to help Marietta. I mean, no one was taking a trip to Hawaii with any of this money.
That is correct. Despite, you know, all of those records being available to appellant, there's not any transaction that he can point to as an impropriety. And Mark himself testified that he believed that his name was on the account as a convenience so that he could write checks on behalf of Marietta, and that is what the banker had advised them to do when they went to the bank.
Well, you know, what are we to do? And I'm sure no one is more aware than this panel of the deference that is generally given to findings of fact to the district court, but, you know, in all candor, given what seems to have been a remarkable turn of events from September 7th to September 8th, I was a little surprised that the district court just kind of glossed over that and didn't say, well, you know what, that seems odd, but I believe Erickson. And then, you know, we wouldn't, well, then I think it would be bulletproof. It's like, yep, it's, I've looked at all this, I've looked at the phone message, this seems a little odd to me, however, I've heard the testimony and, you know, believe Erickson. I mean, why wouldn't we want to remand? Because at the end of the day, we don't have that. And so it's like, well, I mean, a fair question would be, shouldn't this go back so the district court can explain all that? Well, how did that work? Why shouldn't we do that?
I agree that some things in the opinion are a little skinny on what the judge was thinking, but we've already had all of the testimony about it, and the judge decided that he believed him. There is, even though he didn't write about it, there is the two following in-person meetings, two letters at least, to my recollection, that Erickson has sent to his client. This was the middle of the counseling process, not the end. She continued to work with Erickson for more months and eventually signed a different document. It's not unusual for people to change their minds while they're in their estate planning process. Also, this case is really nothing like the other cases where this court has found undue influence. There aren't actually that many cases, but they have a couple of common factors.
Yes, go right ahead, Judge Larkin.
I agree. I would have liked to have seen more findings from the district court explaining the issue of credibility determinations, implied credibility determinations. The one thing I'm struggling with are, you know, these factors you're supposed to consider when determining undue influence. Then one of them has to do with, is the person who was excluded, is that something you would have expected? Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. But so the district court did, I noticed, kind of take note of the extent of contact or lack thereof between Rory and his grandmother in her later years. And do you think that influenced the district court? Because am I correct in understanding that, okay, well, here's some evidence that looks like it could have been undue influence, these attorney meetings, this looks odd. And then if we're a case where, and boy, I can't see any reason why she would have excluded Rory, that seems to go to Rory's arguments. But it seems like, well, you could look at this and go, well, maybe grandma's thinking, well, these people are here, they take care of me, they share my interest. I think there was a statement that Rory has enough money, he doesn't need anything. I haven't seen Rory in years, and I got a letter 2 years before my death. I mean, to me, I guess, you know, I've got 86-year-olds that I deal with. Not so surprising to me that grandma might have said, you know what, he's fine. I'm going to focus on the people who are here taking care of me.
And in his testimony, when Rory was asked, why didn't you visit your mother on your own, he said, and I think this really summarizes it up, there'd be no reason to. Rory was not close to his grandmother. The Battistinis had been for over 30 years. If they were trying to con her, they were playing a really long game because he had been married to their daughter. Mark had been married to Sandra for over 30 years by the time she passed away. He is a very regular, stalwart person, same employer for 35 years, same house, raised two children who went to college in successful careers. He's not the kind of fly-by-night, you know, guy who's trying to pull one over on Marietta. Marietta's known him for decades, And she was very pointed in her opinions, as both Erickson and Mark and Anna and other people who testified pointed out.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, Mr. Crosby.
Where we left off, Judge Larkin asked about the bad faith question on the fees. I would just point the court to the Northfield Care Center case. It's referenced on page 32, note 9 of our main brief. And same sort of issue happened there. There was no explicit finding of whether there was bad faith or not by the court. So this court sent it back. Said,
but we sent it back after summary judgment, not after a trial on the merits, right?
True, but there was still no finding one way or the other on bad faith.
Right, but if you have a trial and you know that the party, well, for my claim, I need a finding of bad faith, and the judge didn't make one, doesn't that party have the ability to move for amended findings and ask the judge to address the bad faith question in that context?
We could. I don't see why it supersedes.
Summary judgment is saying there is an issue of fact here, bad faith. We can't decide it, so we need to send it back. That seems very different than there was a full-blown trial. People had the opportunity to ask for amended findings if they needed it. You know, why do you get a second bite at the apple? Why don't we retrial the case?
Well, I don't think it's a retrial. It's simply a remand back for the same. The Judge Connelly was saying amend these findings on the other point. And I don't think we're required to go back to the district court and say, now clear this up first before we go to the Court of Appeals. It's not my understanding. I wanted to talk briefly about another one of your questions, Judge Larkin, and that had to do with, well, doesn't, you know, what we're hearing from Mark's side is he's got enough. He's well-to-do. And well, first of all, that wasn't her plan up until September 7th. So September 7th, I want him to get up to $100,000. In fact, her initial meeting with Erickson said, when Erickson asked, and Rory steps into the shoes of his late father, and now it's a 50-50 split, is that what you want? And she says, yes, that's what I want. And then Erickson goes on, and this was after his call with Mark a few days earlier, saying, well, what if we changed it and made it, you could make it 70-30 if you wanted. So there is nothing in any of his notes before September 7th when she signs. It's not the middle of the counseling process on September 7th. It's done. You signed a will. It's not to be continued. Who does that? Erickson said, I've never had anybody in my 40 years of practice call me up the next day and say, or tell me the same day that now that I just sign it, rip it up. Because I don't want him in this will at all. But that's what his testimony was. And that's why it's so unbelievable. And that's why it doesn't jive with him where he said at deposition, I never made another will or trust that included him. We found five more. On the question of does he have enough or not, that's not for this court to determine. It's not a substitution, this court or the trial court to determine. That's what the Cosgrove and Smith cases say. It is what it is. I mean, you might say, geez, boy, that person's a saint and this person's the devil, and yet she gave all the money to the devil and ended the saint. That's not the court's decision to say, well, she didn't know what she wanted. I think that's all I had, unless you had further questions.
No. Thank you very much, Mr. Crosby. Thank you, Ms. Lyon. We will issue our decision within 90 days.
Thank you.